Courses in Life Adjustment, The Educational Philosophies of John Dewey, the secondary school curriculum in general have become increasingly during the last decade targets of mounting public criticism in our country. The colleges complained as they were forced to inaugurate programs of remedial English for their freshman classes, as they found that increasingly the new enrollees in their courses were unequipped to express themselves on paper in their native tongue. The high schools complained that an increasing number of able, capable students were choosing after their junior high school years programs which did not demand the utmost of effort on their parts. That these bright students were preferring to undertake courses in business English and general science and basic mathematics rather than to attempt the purely academic program in the foreign languages, in English, in the basic sciences, and in advanced mathematics. The libraries complained that an increasing number of young people were shunning their doors and fewer books were being charged out by elementary and junior high school young people. And many librarians wondered whether the spate of rather insipid reading primers which had been developed for our current public schools, primers of the John goes to school, Mary goes to school, John sees Mary at school variety, had perhaps not completely destroyed the adventure of reading for these young people, and made reading instead a burdensome and a tedious chore. The temple complained. We complained as we watched the reading capacity of our junior high school students drop perceptibly in the first decade after the Second World War. We complained that it was increasingly difficult to teach our young people Jewish history, because they knew no overall framework of world history against which to put into place the climactic events of our own tradition. We complained as it became increasingly difficult to teach our young people the grammar and the syntax of Hebrew, for they had not, many of them, the faintest inkling of the grammar and the syntax of their own tongue. This tide of criticism began to developed in this decade after the Second World War and inflamed into national prominence when, in October of 1957, the Russians launched their first Sputnik into orbit. And this Sputnik, although it was launched from a firing pad 6,000 miles from the nearest school administrator's office, singed with the heat of its backlash, every one of the people in America responsible with our public school education. America's pride was hurt and was humbled by the Russian success in the art of missile rocketry. And as is quite normal, we sought for some scapegoat, somebody on whom to heap the burden for our collective weakness and ineptness and inability. We could no longer blame it on spies, on foreign espionage, as we had blamed previous failures of the last decade, because even the most talented spy cannot steal away secrets which the scientist has not yet developed. So the American people turned their ire at first against the various governmental research agencies who were charged with the responsibility of prosecuting these programs of advanced scientific research. And the agencies, to free themselves of the burden of responsibility, countered by claiming that Congress had not allocated them sufficient funds to carry out the mandate which the people had given them. Congress, to free itself of the responsibility, retorted that the agencies had been allocated funds which they had not been able to use. There was a residue of monies appropriated which had not as yet been tapped. And then the agencies found the perfect scapegoat in the schools. But they said that even had we been given the money that we were given and double and triple the sum, We could not have carried out the mandate of the people to prosecute with the utmost speed programs of basic scientific and missile research because the American public school system had not developed a sufficient number of trained eyes and trained mind and trained hands to work in the laboratories to develop the new weapons and the new sciences. Admiral H.G. Rickover, chief of the Navy's development program in the nuclear submarine field, was possibly the most articulate of all these agency spokesmen who sought to lay the burden of America's scientific weakness at the door of our public school education. Speaking shortly after October of 1957, Admiral Rickover said, "I have interviewed more than 2,000 young men in the last 12 years. My naval reactor engineering group presently numbers about 150. Since the men I have interviewed have already passed through a number of previous interviews which weeded out all but the best, it can be seen that those who could not meet the requirements of the nuclear power project, and hence inferentially of any new development project, vastly outnumbered those who qualified. This experience made a deep impression on me. It led me directly to a study of why our educational system produces so few men who are qualified to do the work which we must do if we are to progress. Our schools are the greatest cultural lag we have today. When I read official publications put out by the men who run our educational system, booklets such as Life Adjustment Education for Every Youth, or Education for All Youth, I have the strange feeling of reading about another world, a world long since departed if it ever existed at all. I sense the kindly spirit, the desire to make every child happy, the earnest determination to give advice on every problem any young person might ever meet in life, and withal, so complete a misunderstanding of the needs of young people in today's world that it frightens me. The public schools found it difficult to parry the charge that they had such a complete misunderstanding of the needs of young people in today's world that it frightened the ablest and keenest observers. And whatever were the rationalizations, the explanations which the schools put forward, local, regional, racial tensions, political pressures, the need to pass school building levies which had diverted the attention of school administrators from the basic function of education, a lack of trained teachers, a lack of all types of staff, a lack of a sufficient school budget. Whatever were these excuses and these rationalizations, the school systems of America found it difficult to convince the American public that they had not become lackadaisical and haphazard in their education, and that they had not made the seeking of a basic education in America a rather haphazard wandering through the byways of human knowledge, rather than a determined and forthright attack on the very core disciplines that make our human culture. Shortly after October of 1957, a Columbia Broadcasting System correspondent interviewed a young Moscow 10th grader. In clipped, careful English, this Russian youth told the radio correspondent of the courses which he took in his public school. Courses in Russian literature, courses in world history, in algebra, in geometry, in advanced physics, in biochemistry, in art, and physical education. And as one listened to this careful detailing of an ambition school program, no one but could be impressed by the extent and the depth of the 10th grade education which this young Russian student was receiving. The Columbia Broadcasting System then taped this interview and played it back to a group of high school students in Tennessee. They asked these students what were their impressions of Ivan's education. The consensus seemed to be that Ivan was to be pitied that he was forced to work so hard, that he was forced to take so many subjects, for certainly too much study would make Ivan a rather dull boy. What was then the purpose of education? And as a group, these young people answered that the purpose of a high school education was to teach you to adjust to a variety of social situations, to teach you to acclimate yourselves to the family and the community in which you live. Not a one of those interviewed said that the purpose of an education was to teach the child basic disciplines of language and of literature, of history, of the classics and of the sciences. As one child put it, there's no one sitting here who wouldn't rather be a drum majorette or a member of the school band than to be the valedictorian of the class. The American school system then seemed to be convicted out of the mouths of its own pupils of having become indifferent to the, after all, the essential discipline and purpose of all education. The development for the young of the knowledge which a society possesses. And as Americans began to consider with more and more determination the Russian school system, as they began to make comparisons, these comparisons were increasingly damning. We discovered, for instance, that in 1919, the Bolsheviks inherited a school system which was designed to educate only the small number who were in the upper classes of the Russian political system. The Russian society was 90% illiterate in 1919. In the same year, we already had developed in America a universal program of elementary and secondary school education. We'd already developed the college system and the system of advanced degrees, which was to be open through scholarship and granting aids to the ablest and to the best of all of our students. 40 years later, in 1959, we find that there are today 2,700,000 American boys and girls carrying on programs of advanced learning at colleges and universities. But there are in Russia today 4,300,000 boys and girls working in similar programs of advanced training. This despite the fact that there are 25% more young people enrolled in the American public school system than in the Russian public school system. As we made comparisons between the Russian school system and our own, these comparisons became increasingly damning. We remember that in 1919, the United States was the most technologically inventive and advanced nation on the face of this globe. We remember that although there were a few competent scientists in the Soviet Union, the vast majority of the Soviet citizens had no inkling of even the nature of our modern scientific age. Today, 40 years later, every Russian high school student to graduate must take courses in advanced algebra, in calculus, in trigonometry and solid geometry, in advanced biology, in advanced chemistry, and advanced physics. And today, 40 years later, there are still 300,000 American boys and girls enrolled in school systems which cannot provide them the facilities to take these very subjects, even if they desire to do so. And there are, in addition, 1,700,000 American boys and girls who graduate each year from our high school who have elected not to take any of these subjects. Perhaps the most damning of all comparisons is the one which we make in our own minds as we read any competent account of the Russian high school system. I should like to read to you a brief description of public school and education in Russia, which you can make in your own mind's eye, whatever comparison you see fit. The basic Russian school, the equivalent of the 12 years of public schooling that is the normal education offered to American students is a 10-year school. The total course is subdivided into three phases, not too different from the organization of the American elementary, junior high, and high school. Grades 1 to 4 roughly resemble the grade school. Grades 5 through 7 introduce some of the more difficult elements of learning and thereby roughly resemble our junior high schools. And grades 8 to 10 are college preparatory and lead to a school leaving examination, which can be roughly compared to the high school diploma. When the Russian 7-year-old begins school in the first grade, his opening weeks are not too different from the same stretch in his life, in the life of his strictly younger American counterpart. The first few weeks might be summed up with the American phrase of orientation. The teacher tells the youngster about the school, about the things they should and should not do, about the proper way of asking questions. Almost at once, the teaching of the alphabet begins. In contrast with American method, which tries to get youngsters ready for reading and writing, and which works backwards, beginning with pictures and entire words, Russia has stuck to the traditional way. Individual letters are learned and practiced. Words are formed containing the familiar letters. New words are broken down to recognition of familiar letters, and the sounds of the letters lead to the discovery of new words. At the end of the first grade, the Russian pupil is expected to be able to read and to write simple texts, to be ready to move on in grade 2 to extensive spelling practice and to the basic knowledge of the rules of grammar. The Soviet pupils who finish elementary school, that is grades 1 through 4, are expected then to be able to read basic texts, many of them with a strongly scientific slant, written especially for this age group. They have been given simple composition and letters to write, and they are frequently tested on the clarity of their speech and expression. Children, American children in those early grades, are generally offered reading matter especially prepared for them, ranging from Mother Goose and Childish Adventure to a certain new type of meaningless double talk scientifically designed by education specialists. Russian youngsters in these early grades get acquainted with Russian folk stories as well as with such authors as Pushkin, Tolstoy, Gorky, and Fadayev. In the first 4 grades, the Russian child is required to learn addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division of whole numbers. Addition and subtraction of fractions, concepts of time, and the metric system. The beginnings of science teaching in the Russian elementary school are not very different from those of the American counterpart. The original purpose is to awaken the child's interest in nature and to give him some inkling of the ways in which nature works, how one season follows the other, what the sun and water and fire do for the world and its people, what the process of eating and the growing of food means to the life of animals and human beings. Not unlike the American grade school, the Russian classroom may have its pet goldfish and turtles. A not uncommon adjunct of classroom education is the garden plot, or at least a few window boxes for city classroom children. Russian children do, however, enter into a far more systematic study of natural science considerably earlier than do most American youngsters. In 4th grade, they are introduced to the basic study of the composition of water, air, soil, the elements, minerals, and the scientific problems of growth and of change. Even taking into consideration the fact that the American first grader starts school when a year younger, the Russian child begins basic instruction in natural science 2 years earlier than his American counterpart. What is more significant, the natural science course in the 4th grade is merely the prelude to an organized 3-year elementary science curriculum that starts in the 5th grade. It includes laboratory work, practical semi-scientific gardening, and meaningful observation through a microscope. The Russian 5th grade, if it is to be looked on as the beginning of the junior high school, opens to the pupil a truly new world of learning. He is now prepared for a curriculum of study which includes weekly 9 hours of Russian language and literature, 6 hours of mathematics, 2 hours of history, 3 hours of geography, 2 hours of biology, 2 hours of physical education, 2 hours of some form of practical work, either on the farm or in the workshop, and 1 hour each of art and of music. He is also introduced here to a foreign language and devotes 4 hours a week to its study. In the sixth grade, the Russian school adds to its biology teaching 2 hours per week of a second science, usually physics, while reducing only the Russian language and literature instruction by 1 hour, from 9 to 8 hours a week. In the seventh grade, all the earlier subjects continue on the study plan, but with another reduction of Russian by 2 hours. On the other hand, biology and physics are both increased from 2 hours to 3, with the addition of 2 hours of chemistry and 1 hour of technical drawing. Foreign language instruction is reduced from 4 to 3 hours, and both art and singing are dropped from the curriculum entirely. By this time, the Russian student is deep in the study of algebra and of geometry, but he has also, by the end of the seventh grade, covered the history of the world from the prehistoric period in the ancient Orient to Greece, Rome, the Middle Ages, up to the English bourgeois revolution of 1648. The Russian student enters senior high school in his eighth grade. He is now about 14 years of age. The Russian high school student switches from Russian entirely to a consideration of the literature of his people, an indication that at least in theory he is expected to have mastered the techniques of writing, spelling, and grammar by that time. In his eighth grade, the Russian student continues to devote about 6 hours a week to mathematics, a pace he will maintain through the ninth and the tenth grades. In addition, he studies history for 4 hours, which he will do for the remainder of his high school, geography for about 2 to 3 hours a week, and a foreign language which he continues for 3 weekly lessons each school year. His science requirements permit biology to taper off to 2 hours in the eighth grade and 1 hour in the ninth. Physics, on the other hand, builds up from 3 hours in the eighth grade to 4 in the ninth and better than 5 hours a week in his senior year. He keeps up his weekly hour of technical drawing and the 2 weekly hours of physical education, and adds in his final year 1 hour each of astronomy, psychology, and by way of a last-minute reminder of the powers of the Russian state, of course, in the Constitution of the Soviet Union. Even in his practical work, stepped up to 2 hours a week during the entire 3-year period, he has now advanced to such intricate areas as machine construction and electrotechnology. One cannot but be impressed by this curriculum. One cannot but realize that a youngster who has passed the very difficult baccalaureate examinations at the end of a high school program is infinitely better prepared in academic programs than the overwhelming majority of those of our American boys and girls who win their high school diplomas. And increasingly, determined American parents and civic leaders have questioned whether or not the American public school has been entirely too complacent, too easygoing, too unconcerned with presenting to the young people the vast curriculum of knowledge which will be required to live as citizens of a very complicated scientific age. But before we undertake to ask our school boards to refashion and re-sculpt the American school system in the model of the Russian system, we ought to know and to keep in mind the full picture. We ought to remember that the Russian school system attempts only to produce a trained technician, a cog in the wheel of the Russian economic system. While the American school system aims to develop a productive person, yes, but also a competent and capable citizen. And so the Russian classroom tends to be a lecture hall, a place for the absorption and the ingestion of knowledge and nothing more. While the American classroom must, of necessity, play a dual role, must be a lecture room, a place for the ingestion of knowledge. But it must also be a debating hall, a meeting place, a place where ideas and values can be exchanged between the teacher and the students, between the students and their neighbors, so that in this exchange the young people can develop the techniques of social living and the concepts of community responsibility, which are so important for an educated citizen. We ought to remember also that the Russian school system is one which is concerned only with academic competence. The child who is emotionally disturbed, the child who is a slow learner, the child who has physical handicap, the child who matures slowly is given no second chance. Only 50% of those who enroll in the first grade graduate from the fourth grade. Only one half of those who pass into the junior high school of the Russian system graduate from that junior high school. And only some 15 to 20% of those who enroll in the first grade are finally given the degree of completion at the end of the 10th grade. These have learned, yes, far more than many of our American high school graduates. But what a carnage of broken lives and broken hopes have been left behind strewn along this way. What of the child who is bright and who is able and who is sensitive and who cannot take the pressure of the difficult examinations, the 32 statewide examinations which the Russian school system demand of every youngster before he completes the 10 years. In the first four grades, these young people are simply siphoned off into what are called labor reserve schools. Here they are trained in some semi-skilled vocation and assigned to a place on a production line which will be theirs till death takes them from this earth, or until some Russian czar determines that there must be a major reshuffling of the Russian labor force. If they fail in the junior high school years, they are sent to a technicum or vocational school, a school in standards far below those of our vocational high schools. And here they are given some on-the-job training again in semi-skilled activities which the Russian economy requires at that time. There is never any attempt to reach these young people who fail the examination and to train them up to the limits of their abilities and of their talents, whatever these may be. The child in Russia is not academically and intellectually capable. He stands no chance within the Russian system. Finally, we ought to remember that the Russian system represents, in essence, a copy of the continental educational system. And Americans a century and a half ago rejected this continental educational system for good and for sufficient reasons. We rejected it because it was callous to the needs of those boys and girls who were not, as we have said, intellectually capable. We rejected it because it made a fetish of the earning of degrees, because it created a degreed class who felt themselves superior to and patronizing towards the undegreed mass. A class which in times of prosperity demanded the kowtow, and in times of economic depression were ripe for fascist influence. We rejected this system for good and sufficient reason, and we ought not now, under the pressure of international fear, to demand that our educators develop on the American scene a system which we avoided then, should avoid and shun now. We ought not to forget that the American system, having broken with its European parent, was the first to pioneer in the field of aptitude testing and to demand that the classroom assignments given to a child be up to the limit of the child's ability and no more, that an unable child be not forced to beat his head unavailingly against a standard which he will never be able to attain, and that the brightest of children be set the highest of standards and not be allowed to slide by with work which they can do, as the children themselves say, with one hand tied behind their back. We in America have pioneered, impressively so, in the training of the handicapped child, and the exceptional child, the slow learning child, the retarded child, the child who is gifted in areas which are not purely academic. And our schools have done wonderful work in this respect. And we in America are the one country in the face of the globe who have graduated generation after generation of high school and college people, and who have not had develop a self-contained intellectual elite, a group who felt their rank and their privilege. We in America judge a man not by the degrees he had earned, the cape which he is able to wear on graduation day, but by the accomplishments which he manifests in his daily life. And this is to the good. The European system reflects the aristocratic political world in which it was born. The American system was designed to reflect the democratic political system in which it was born. A system which said, which we will invest 12 years of training in each child, and that we will develop for each child whatever talents he may have, whatever capacities may be his, because we need this child, whatever his capacity, as a citizen, as a member of our community, as a productive member of our economy. But having said all this, the Russian educational accomplishment still gives us pause. There are still areas of major fault which we can, without equivocation, lay at the feet of our school administrators, of our school boards, of our teachers, and of our parent-teachers groups. Our American school system has been lazy. It has been sloppy. It has been unconcerned with the standards of excellence. It's allowed itself to follow the easy way of convenience and social acceptance. When Dr. Conant, sometime president of Harvard College, was commissioned to undertake a year-long study of the American high school system for the Carnegie Institute, many wondered what his findings would be about our American school system. His findings tended to center in one area, that our school systems were no longer challenging the brightest and the ablest of its students. They were no longer offering enough academically, intellectually, culturally, artistically to these young people, that they had overloaded the program of extracurricular, and that they had not spent enough time and attention on the curriculum itself. As he wrote, the 55 schools I have visited, all of which have a good reputation, are at all representative of American public high schools. I think one general criticism would be in order. The academically talented student, as a rule, is not being sufficiently challenged, does not work hard enough, and his program of academic subjects is not of sufficient range. The able boys too often specialize in mathematics and science to the exclusion of foreign languages and to the neglect of English and social studies. The able girls, on the other hand, too often avoid mathematics and science as well as all foreign languages. Our American school system has tended to reflect the general air of smugness and self-complacency which has inflicted the American people since the end of the Second World War. And not only have we failed to stimulate the ablest of our students, but we have even failed at times to challenge the vast middle group of talented students. We have allowed them to slip through school, handing in compositions which, in terms of the basic English disciplines, are abominably sketchy and ill-devised, allowing them to appear before school teachers and to claim that homework is really an unfair labor practice, allowing them to become so overly involved in after-school programs and leisure time activities and extracurricular affairs that they have no time for the major schoolwork, the learning of the basic disciplines without which you cannot first prosecute an able and an adult life. Is frightening. Frightening indeed when American high school students feel that the 10th grade education of a Russian young student will only tend to make him a dull boy. When these same students tend to feel that the purpose of education is to gain in popularity, to learn the arts of social living rather than the techniques of logical and clear thinking and the disciplines of academic learning. This is the challenge that faces the American school system. We need a system which will demand of its students the finest level of work of which that student is capable. To achieve this, we will need better teachers and we will need more teachers. Perhaps as a nation, we will have to cease worrying about building the more magnificent school classrooms and to pass school levies and bond issues designed to raise the standard of living of the teacher class so that we can attract to the classroom the finest of the young college graduates. Russia makes no boast of the beauty or the architectural and aesthetic values of its school plan. It has remembered that the teacher is more important than the classroom. And though today America can boast of the most beautifully designed and built school system ever known by man, there is one teacher to every 17 students in the Russian school system, and there is one teacher to every 30 school pupils in our own. For the Russians have remembered a basic universal maxim of education. It is not the quality of the classroom, but the quality of the classroom teacher that determines the quality of the study. We need to demand more of our teachers. We need to allow them less to siphon their energies off into programs of teacher training. All too often, a bright student in high school is frustrated in his attempt to carry out some program of individual research because he is quickly asking questions which are beyond the competence of his high school teacher. In Russia, before a teacher can enter a high school science classroom, he must have 340 hours of the science which he will teach. In most American school systems, he needs to have only 32 hours of the science which will be his field to teach for life. We must demand of our high school faculties greater and greater effort on their own parts to stimulate, to learn the facts which they must teach. We must demand leadership of our school administrations. That's the kind of leadership which passes bond issues by saying that the school will be open at all hours for badminton leagues and for swimming parties. But the kind of leadership which says that our school in this community will teach the finest type of learning that is possible to communicate to the young people. And we will test each young person. We will try to motivate him along the areas of his talent, which will try to acquaint him with the world in which he lives, which we will try to equip him with a knowledge without which he cannot make intelligent decisions later in his life. History plays strange tricks. The United States was built by men and women who had their roots deeply set down in European soil. To create so much of that which made for the American genius, they cut these roots. They began programs of invention, organizational remodeling to create the institutions which they wanted to express their democratic way of life. Now there comes to us again a European challenge. The answer to this challenge does not lie in overly hastily copying ourselves after a Russian image, and perhaps accepting in the process social and political values which are abhorrent to us. But it lies in remembering that the genius of the European system, whatever its faults, lay in its emphasis on intellectual excellence. And that the genius of the American school system can only be vindicated if we will in the future determinedly work to achieve the same quality of educational excellence. No longer can our schools be second-rate They must be the finest schools which the world can devise and which man can develop. And if they are, and I feel confident that they will become so, then surely our future is secure. For the young people who are the fodder that we feed into these schools are the finest caliber of potential. They have so much. We equip them with life, with the intelligence and the discipline and knowledge which they will require. And surely they will lead us into a world of peace, a world which is our fondest dream. Amen.